From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we continue our discussion on the state of African American theater with James Chapman. His play, Our Young Black Men Are Dying and Nobody Seems to Care, was a big hit on the so-called Chitlin Circuit. But he left the circuit because some of the producers were also drug dealers and were unscrupulous businessmen. Now Chapman's plays tour college campuses and community groups. Also, Kevin Whitehead reviews a collection of Count Basie recordings made in the decade before his death in 1984. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Flooding on the Ohio River is getting worse in western Kentucky and southern Indiana. Towns further upstream are still cleaning up from last week's heavy rains. Mike Martini of member station WVXU reports from Cincinnati.
The flooded Ohio River is expected to crest in Evansville, Indiana tomorrow and in Paducah, Kentucky on Friday. In Louisville, the river has dropped about 3 feet but remains well above flood stage. To date, the flood of 1997 is being blamed for hundreds of millions of dollars in damage to parts of 5 Midwestern states. In Cincinnati, hit hard by flooding last week, the river is expected to finally slip below flood stage sometime later today. Neighboring river communities have begun backbreaking cleanup work, scraping and shoveling inches of mud, and attempting to salvage what they can to restart their lives. 6 mobile federal emergency recovery centers have been dispatched and will tomorrow begin accepting applications for financial assistance. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Martini in Cincinnati.
Former employees of National Security Council Chief Anthony Lake are being questioned today by Senate investigators. The investigators are trying to find out if the National Security Council officials ever had any contact with Democratic Party fundraisers who are now being checked out by the Justice Department. This comes on the eve of Lake's confirmation hearings before the Senate Intelligence Committee. He's being nominated to lead the CIA. The former Lake staffers do not have to answer the questions, but Committee Chairman Richard Shelby says if they don't, they could be subpoenaed. The Palestinians' chief negotiator has offered his resignation. There's a dispute with Israel that could delay the redeployment phase of Israeli troops out of the West Bank. Lori Neff reports from Jerusalem.
Negotiator Mahmoud Abbas has offered his resignation in frustration over what a Palestinian official calls recent setbacks with the Israelis. Aides say Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat hasn't decided whether to accept it. The move comes after Palestinians last night formally rejected Israel's plans to turn over another 9% of the West Bank to the Palestinians. The Palestinians say the transfer is too small and complain that they were not consulted about the redeployment plan. Palestinians are also enraged over Israeli plans to build a Jewish neighborhood in mainly Arab East Jerusalem and close down 4 East Jerusalem offices allegedly run by the Palestinian Authority. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu left Israel for a visit to Russia today, but left behind several top aides to maintain contacts with the Palestinians. For National Public Radio, I'm Lori Neff in Jerusalem.
British authorities in Birmingham say 4 people died in 2 massive vehicle pileups today. About 90 cars and trucks crashed into each other in heavy fog south of the city. 60 people were hurt and 15 vehicles caught fire. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up nearly 30.5 points at 7,031. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the Dow Jones blue chips are extending a rally from last Friday. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
Much of the market's rise is being led by health products companies, which have benefited from a study claiming some commonly used pain relievers appear to reduce the risk of Alzheimer's disease. Shares in American Home Products, Bristol Myers Squibb, and Procter & Gamble are all higher. H.J. Heinz has risen following reports the company plans to cut 6% of its workforce in a restructuring. On the other hand, shares in Office Depot have fallen after the Federal Trade Commission rejected the company's proposed merger with Staples. I'm Doug Krisner.
A published report says former NBC programming chief Brendan Tartikoff is going to work for America Online. The Wall Street Journal says AOL is expected to announce shortly that it's buying an online production firm and will form an entertainment division that Tartikoff will head. He would be the second television catch for AOL. Robert Pittman, formerly of MTV, is heading up America Online's service division. A published report alleges federal welfare dollars are being used on other projects in several states. USA Today reports the strong economy and a dip in welfare caseloads have freed up the money for other uses. Most states are spending the surplus money to help welfare recipients with child care. But California now plans to spend $141 million on juvenile probation programs, and Connecticut has budgeted for nutrition and housing. Experts say that these states ought to save money for bad times. They say that in the past, people who rotate off welfare only return later. I'm Korva Coleman, National Public Radio News from Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, for reporting on disadvantaged youth and families, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We've done a couple of shows recently about race and theater. We brought you the New York Town Hall debate between August Wilson and Robert Brustein on whether African-American performers have a responsibility to remain in black-identified theater. We also spoke to Henry Louis Gates about his New Yorker article called The Chitlin Circuit. Gates says if you're really looking for a theater of black folk, by black folk, and for black folk, the place to find it is the Chitlin Circuit, where the audiences are blue-collar and pink-collar and not the type to attend traditional theater. Gates describes a typical play there as melodrama with abundant comic relief and a handful of gospel songs, material that makes the old sitcom Good Times look like Strindberg. In that article, Gates spoke to playwright James Chapman, who got off the Chitlin Circuit because some of the producers appeared to be drug dealers. Chapman's play, Our Young Black Men Are Dying and Nobody Seems to Care, was a big hit on the circuit. Now it's a big hit on college campuses and with community groups. His other touring plays include What About Black Women, Black Man Rising, and Women with Wings. Chapman co-founded the production company Living the Dream, which is based in Columbus, Ohio. I asked him his reaction to the town hall debate.
I think it's really much ado about nothing. I think we need to be focusing on how to educate the masses about the power and beauty of live theater and not trying to segregate it or integrate it. Just let it be what it is. So much energy appears to be put on who is doing what instead of what is being done, if that makes any sense.
Now, you have several plays now that are on the road, and your latest play, The Colored Lady Society, just opened in Columbus, Ohio. When you started out, your play, Our Young Black Men Are Dying and Nobody Seems to Care, was very popular on what's being called the Chitlin Circuit.
Yes.
What is the circuit?
The circuit is a group of promoters, some very unscrupulous, some people just having a little money to spend and wanting to make it big, that rent large halls in cities that have usually African-American radio stations and large African-American populations, and they promote plays like rock concerts are promoted, and they bring in thousands of people into these huge halls, and we do plays. The problem with that is the quality of the performance is usually compromised, and the integrity of the business relationship is usually very questionable.
What's questionable about it?
Well, a lot of times we never would consider getting paid after a show was over. A lot of times we would be paid in cash, or if we were paid by check, the check would be absolutely no good. I remember experiences where we were manipulated into thinking monies were there and they actually weren't there, and it was just a terrible experience for me. One time in Dallas, Texas, I ended up spending the night in jail because I didn't know any better, and I took these people at their word. We did all these shows, sold out 4 performances in a large auditorium in Dallas. I believe it was around 1,700 seats, and they set me in a room, told me how much money we had made, and told me what my share would have been if I had been more cooperative, and then gave me $5,000 in cash and told me to take it or sue them. And of course there was nobody to sue because they had concocted this whole make-believe company that I had signed the contract with, and I became very, very irate, to say the least. And one of the promoters, it's kind of funny, stood about 6 feet seven. He was a former football player. And here I was, I stand about 5'7", and he had me by at least 150 pounds. But I tried to punch him anyway, Terry. I was so angry, I didn't know what else to do. So I got scared, so I called the police on myself and told them if they didn't arrest me, I was going to kill somebody so I wouldn't be around these people, because I didn't know what they were going to do to me.
You had yourself arrested?
I had myself arrested and spent the night in jail to protect myself, literally. It was a sobering experience, and was during that time that I realized that that's not why I do theater. There's so many talented writers and actors that want to do this, and they see the response that these audiences give because they love these plays. You know, we were going, the Performing Arts Center in Milwaukee, Wisconsin is a classic example. Twice we were there, 2,300 seats filled to capacity. People seeing a play about our young black men dying, full of the music and the comedy and the drama and all of that, and they stood at their feet and they applauded. Then afterwards, we were inundated by hundreds of people who wanted to audition, to join with us, to do it themselves. And these promoters identify these people. They prostitute their talents and they take them on joy rides, if you will, and usually end up hurting their feelings. It would have been much better for us if they had been much more realistic about the expectations and if they had dealt with us in a business-like manner. There's nothing wrong with the market. There's some serious problems with the marketing. You know, they really don't have any scruples at all.
In the Henry Louis Gates article about African-American theater today, he said that some of the producers, some of the backers on the Chitlin circuit are really drug dealers who've made a lot of money and are now investing some of that in theater. Does that jive with your experiences?
Yes, it does, very much so. I can give you an example of why I believe this. Now, nobody comes up to you and says, I am a drug dealer and I want to back your play. But we were approached and did business with people who were only accessible through voicemail and pager and cellular phone numbers, who never had addresses, who we would Federal Express them documents to hotels or receive letters with no return address. You know, they would do financial transactions either in cash or through money transfer, sometimes from banks from other countries, it seemed. And there was just this whole clandestine atmosphere. And they didn't seem concerned about losing money. You know, a legitimate producer promoter type is going to be concerned if a show does not make money. These people in some markets, they seem to put us in these markets, do minimal marketing, and you could just do the math and tell that there was no money made, and they were just happy. They would pay us with no problems. And what we believe is this was a way to legitimize illegitimate funds, to launder money, if you will. We did know, as doing this, that many of these people had been were ex-convicts. There was a particular promoter who had gotten out of jail, and he told us that he went down in his mother's basement and pulled a brick out of the wall and got the money to promote the show. Now, I later got up the courage to ask him what he was in jail for, and it was bank robbery. So I kind of chuckled with my actors. I said, I think he robbed a bank to bring us to this city, because it seemed like that. And there aren't any checks and balances. As long as the venue gets paid, as long as the performers get paid, nobody really ask who are you and why are you doing this, and I don't know what right we do have to even ask those types of questions.
So you often got paid just in cash up front?
When we dealt on that circuit, we would not accept checks after a point,
right?
Because not one time, not once, did we accept a check that was good.
Well, what would you do with all the cash? It's not a good thing to be carrying a whole lot of cash, especially if people know that you have a lot of cash.
Well, we would be very discreet about that, and we worked out arrangements with our bank that we could go into banks in various cities and make deposits, and they would handle them for us and get them to our accounts. And a lot of times, because we were paid in cash, we would turn around and pay our performers and our vendors in cash. In fact, one time it was just so funny. I was sitting in a tour bus at a table with stacks of money for everybody. And it was kind of sad because when it was over, there was no stack of money for me. But we paid our hotel in cash. We paid our travel person in cash. We paid our bus company in cash. And we paid each of the actors and the musicians in cash. And I just transferred the worry from myself to them because never did we have anything happen that was where somebody tried to rob us or anything. But there were some times when we were very afraid that that was going to happen.
How did you feel during the period you were on the circuit, knowing that a lot of the backers you were working with were unscrupulous or had made their money through underworld activities?
Terry, I felt like a total hypocrite. That's why I got off the circuit. How can you do a play about the things that are destroying the lives of African-American men and women and then support the people that are culpable in that destruction? There's no way you can do that. And as an artist, while I want my work to be out there, I don't want it to be out there at any cost. So I had to make a decision that I would give it up before I would compromise the integrity of my company, of my work. And it was a very difficult decision because that was a lot of money. That was a lot of exposure. That was, you know, it's nice to be in a different city every day with when we were in Houston, every television station did a feature story on us. You know, we would go to places and people would treat us like royalty. We loved it, but I would rather not do any plays or do them in my church basement before I would work with people like that. And it took some time to convince the people working with me that I was right in that, but I feel much better now.
How did you get on the circuit in the first place?
Well, it was a phenomenal situation. My play premiered on June 9th, 1990. Within 6 months, it was off Broadway. It ran off Broadway for 36 weeks. And during the time it ran off Broadway, people began to approach us. And unfortunately, I decided I needed a manager. And so a gentleman approached me to be my manager who had been a rock and roll promoter prior to and had connections with these people. And before we knew it, we were in tour buses or driving across the country or on airplanes flying across the country. And after all was said and done, he was more their manager than my manager because he was in cahoots with them. And it was a very, very disappointing experience and took us so far off track that we still, in my opinion, aren't in the legitimate theater circuit that I would like to be in.
My guest is playwright James Chapman. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. James Chapman is my guest, and he's the author of such plays as Our Young Black Men Are Dying and Nobody Seems to Care, The Colored Ladies Society, Black Men Rising, and What About Black Women? When you decided you had to get off the Chitlin Circuit because of the unscrupulous activities of many of the backers there, what were your alternatives?
Well, our alternative was to focus on the quality of the work and let it do whatever, you know. And what I mean by that is we had developed a small niche in performing at colleges and universities, and we decided to work at making that a larger niche and also in making sure that what we were doing was good. And I may be a little naive in this, but I believe if you do something good, eventually people will notice it. And that's what happened. You know, we started, we simplified our company, reduced our overhead, cut out a lot of the frills, and just came back down to that theater company that I wanted to start in the first place and started focusing on the content and the artistic integrity of the plays and made them affordable and available to colleges and universities. And now we perform at nearly 200 schools a year.
How does the whole ambience within the theater change when you started doing colleges and universities and community groups as opposed to the Chitlin Circuit?
Oh, Terry, it was night and day. It went from this experience of being big star to being catalyst for change, you know. And it's humbling when sometimes we perform for maybe 30 or 40 people in a coffee house, and the connection is so real and honest. And they come up to us afterwards. In one of my plays, Women with Wings, one of the scenes is about breast cancer. And there's nothing for us to have an experience after the play when one of the people in the audience will come and share a personal story about their experience with breast cancer. Or in our young black men, when we talk about crack, there's nothing for somebody to come up to us and say, you know, I am in recovery. I used to smoke crack. Or my brother died, you know. At the end of our young black men, we invite people to come up and write names in a notebook that we read at the next performance of young black men who have died. And it's so personal and so real now. And the atmosphere in the company is so much... So different, it's so focused, and that we believe that we're not just performers anymore. We believe that we're literally actors on a mission.
You have a funny and strange story about something that happened in a Bronx venue when you were performing. Would you tell that story?
Yes. One of the scenes in the play Our Young Black Men is a scene where two characters come out and they are pretending to be robbers, and they say, you know, put all your belongings in a bag, and one of them has a fake gun and he's brandishing it. And we thought it would be neat, since we were going to the Bronx and this was in the neighborhood, that we would start our little excerpt with that scene. And so the actors ran out and said, okay, put all your stuff in the bag, and Rogers rings money. And before he could get through the first sentence, there were people pulling guns, people running, people screaming. One lady hid up under a table and would not come out, even though we stopped everything and said, yo, this is just a play. This is not real. And we learned, very importantly, don't go into the neighborhood doing something like that. They don't make that separation. And it caused us to realize that we have to be very careful. But it also was humbling in the fact that we really have pushed a particular nerve in portraying through theater something that is very, very real in the lives and experiences of so many people.
I know that there are a lot of people in theater who feel pretty bad about how difficult it can be to attract people to the theater. I guess what you're trying to do is to take theater into the community, where it's in a different setting than the theater.
Yeah, and I guess that goes back to the very first issue we talked about as far as this debate about African-American theater. When I look at theater, I look at a long history of theater that goes beyond contemporary theater. I look at Africa. I look at Greece. I look at theater being kind of a pulse of the people, theater being the media of the people, and the idea of telling stories and conveying history and ideas. And if you're going to do that, you don't wait for people to come and hear the stories or get the history. Sometimes you find them and you provoke them into wanting to know, what is it you're talking about? What do you mean by that? You challenge them to listen and understand what you have to say. And a lot of times we don't do that. We can get very elitist and very, if I can just say it the way I say it, we get snobby about it. And we think that people ought to appreciate what we're trying to do and ought to want to come and see us and ought to know that they should pay ungodly amounts of money to see this and be privileged for the opportunity. When the reality is, television and other mediums have really created a strong competition for us that we haven't risen to. I think we have to be very aggressive in saying live theater is different. Live theater is still provocative and challenging, but live theater also is accessible. And I see my plays as a bridge to the grander plays, if you will. I would like to think that there are people who would go see an August Wilson play after seeing one of my plays, because now they have a better understanding and appreciation of what theater is and what theater is all about.
James Chapman is my guest, the author of such plays as Our Young Black Men Are Dying and Nobody Seems to Care, The Colored Lady Society, and What About Black Women? You have a pretty interesting story yourself. Your father was a minister. Was church a big part of your childhood?
Oh, church was the only part. There was a civil rights movement and there was church. And, and they were connected to each other because my father was a follower of Martin Luther King. And so without a doubt, church was a definite part of my childhood.
Now, your parents are active in the civil rights movement.
Yes.
You're gay. When your father found out that you were gay, did he make a connection between the civil rights movement and your rights as a gay person?
To this day, he does not make that connection. In fact, that's one of the things that we don't talk about, because he would tell you, like so many people in the civil rights movement would tell you, that there is absolutely no connection between the two, because one is a condition with which a person is born and the other is a lifestyle that a person chooses, in his opinion. I remember very vividly when I was 14 years old and he suspected that I might be homosexual. He set us down and he, all of us, my brothers, my sister, my mother, myself, on the front porch of our home, and he read to us from the first chapter of Romans in the Bible. And it spoke of men having sex with men and being given over to reprobate mind. And at 14 years old, I didn't know what the word reprobate meant. So I asked, what does it mean? And he told me it means God has thrown you away and will never have anything to do with you again. And I know that his intention was to make me straighten up and fly right. But the result of that statement to me was depression that lasted many years. I remember going upstairs and burning my copies of Cosmopolitan magazine that had Jim Brown and Burt Reynolds in them. And
were they pinups,
yes,
for you?
They were. That I was in Newton, Kansas. What can I say? I was, and I remember praying, fervently praying, as the Bible told me to, for God to remove this demon of homosexuality from me, and to not turn his back on me. And when it didn't leave me, I thought for years, like so many gay men, I thought I was cursed, and proceeded on a set of life choices that acted as though I was cursed, and that led me to literally being homeless and very, very depressed. Terry, I don't think that there's any way I can convey to people how deep I was in depression.
James Chapman will be back with us in the second half of our show. His production company, Living the Dream, is based in Columbus, Ohio, where his new play, The Colored Lady Society, is running through the end of March. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with playwright James Chapman. His best-known play, Our Young Black Men Are Dying and Nobody Seems to Care, was a big hit on the so-called Chitlin' Circuit. He got off the circuit because some of the producers appeared to be drug dealers. He found an alternate home for his plays, college campuses and community groups, where they've been quite successful. When we left off, Chapman told us about the depression that overcame him after his father, a minister, figured out Chapman was gay and told Chapman he was depraved. This left Chapman feeling that his homosexuality was a curse from God. He says that contributed to his becoming homeless. How did you end up homeless?
Well, I was in college, and I was doing very well in some aspects of school, but in the academic aspects, I wasn't doing well because I couldn't focus. One of the symptoms of depression is you can't sit still and concentrate on anything for a long time. And I was spending my time doing strange things. For example, I would go to these cruising places where gay men would hang out, and I would go there and I would hang out there from 10 o'clock at night until 5, 6, 7 o'clock in the morning, get up and go to class. So needless to say, I dropped out of school because I was going to be kicked out if I hadn't dropped out. Found myself in Houston, Texas. I don't know why it was Houston. I guess because it was the closest big city to me at the time. And thought I had things under control. Lost the little room I had rented. My car broke down, and I could not call my parents and say, look, you know, I'm having a hard time. So when I would communicate with them, I would lie to them. I would tell them, I'm in school. You know, I transferred. Things are okay. And because of the type of relationship we had, they didn't really investigate. They just assumed I was telling the truth. But I stayed with friends for a minute, and then when friends ran out, I stayed in vacant houses, or I would, you know, walk down the street until some man in a fancy car would pick me up and take me to his home, and in exchange for sex, I would get a night's sleep and a meal. I was very young, and I'm blessed to be alive when I look retrospectively at the choices I made. But I was thinking I was cursed. So thinking that God had turned his back on me, I really felt like I had no reason to live. Because from the time I was a little boy, I was taught that life's ultimate goal is to die and go to heaven. And since I couldn't die and go to heaven, I figured, well, I may as well live. And I thought that was living. And I was in that world where drugs and alcohol and sexual promiscuity, right at the beginning of the AIDS epidemic, were very, very prevalent. And it's just amazing from my perspective that I can sit here and talk about it.
Well, you've said before that you actually thought very seriously about suicide, and that a suicide note turned out to run very long and to be the beginning of your writing career. What exactly happened there?
Well, I had this plan. I was going to jump off of a very tall building at rush hour in Houston, Texas, and I was going to leave this letter to my mother that would be my statement, my vindication, my treatise to the world as to why, as a black gay man, I could never have been accepted. But what happened when I started writing and started trying to explain to my mother what the world really was like, I found room to breathe. It became therapy for me. And it also gave me the ability to look more objectively at my situations. While I could be angry and hurt by what my father said, while I could be angry and hurt by the racism that was around me, I made the choice to either accept the energy that came from that, or to accept the love and support that came from people like my mother, who taught me about unconditional love, like the few teachers who believed in me and encouraged me and pushed me, like those strangers that would speak to me and look at me not as a homeless person, but as a whole person.
Can I just stop you for a second? You said your mother taught you about unconditional love. Do you feel like she practiced it after she found out you were gay?
She did, but she was in a very difficult situation. My mother is a professional minister's wife. She now is 67 years old, and my father is 74. And for the last 47 years, she has been a minister's wife. And in the biblical definition of a minister's wife, she is to forsake all others, including her children, and follow her husband. And she explained to me very clearly that while she would always love me, that she did not want me or any of my siblings to put her in a position of having to choose between us and our father, because that was a choice that she believed that as a Christian she could not make.
So, in
other words, if we didn't do what Daddy said, we had to go. That was the bottom line. I love you, but bye-bye, you know. And I now that I'm older and a little wiser, I appreciate that. She is totally dependent upon my father emotionally, financially, physically. And if she had stood against them, being the person he was, it probably would have meant in the end of their marriage. And I don't think that would have been a good choice for her, because I could not have filled the void that would have been left if that marriage had ended. And plus, she's eternally hopeful. She, to this day, when she talks to me, she will talk to me in terms of one day my father will understand me a little better and things will be better. But he would want me to tell you that he no longer believes that God turns gay people over to reprobate minds, and he loves his children even though he may not approve of all of the things I do. That's the compromise we've made in the years.
So how much do you talk?
Oh, about once a month. Uh-huh. Typical 37-year-old and parents, you know, once a month if it's good. And it's usually, you know, media events bring us together. I call him on election night. I call him when there's a new verdict in the O.J. Simpson trial. I call him, you know, when there's a new scandal in Washington. So we make sure we have something of substance to talk about that is not personal, because we don't talk about the personal things. It's too painful for us both.
My guest is playwright James Chapman. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is playwright James Chapman. His best-known play, Our Young Black Men Are Dying and Nobody Seems to Care, is a big hit on college campuses. What were a couple of steps along the way between your suicide note and getting back on your feet?
One of the steps was a very strange experience that I will never forget. I don't know who the woman was, but there was an older black woman one day. I was walking down the street. I had not bathed. I was in very dirty clothes, and I looked like one of those homeless people that people avoid. This woman walked in my direction, and I looked at her. And as I would do with people, I would look away. But then she forced me by talking to me to look at her. And, you know, she struck up a conversation with me, just asking me how I was doing. And then she looked at me and she said, "Is there anything you need?" And I looked at her and I realized that this was an individual that was speaking to me out of compassion, you know, and I didn't know what to say, because I had thought that there was no compassion for me in this world. And it was obvious in her tone and in her disposition that she didn't care whether I was homeless or dirty or gay or black or anything. She just cared that I was. And that, along with the writing, caused me to start asking some very fundamental questions about who I am and why am I here. And I realized that I cannot blame it on white people. I cannot blame it on homophobes. I have to blame it on myself if I don't get all I can out of life. And what I mean by that, I'm not letting these people off the hook, but I am saying that I have the power in me to be happy or to take all that negative stuff. And it wasn't an overnight thing, but in the 13, 14 years since I was homeless, I have really learned to turn negative things, manure, if you will, into fertilizer.
So where'd you go first after, you know, you tried to get back on
track?
Well,
it was a journey, let me tell you. I had a little manipulation in me. I talked some people into buying me a bus ticket to Columbus, Ohio, because I had read about it in a I think U.S. News and World Report type article in one of those news magazines. And it said it was one of the bustling cities in the East, and it was closer to New York. Because remember now, I had this little play I had written, and I thought I would die in New York, so I wanted to get close. And Columbus was the East for me at that time. So I went to Columbus, and I lived in a shelter in Columbus, and found a group of people in a church, a very interesting inner city Methodist church. All the members were either were women, with the exception of three men, all over the age of 60. And these women in this small church just took me in. And literally, I have to tell you one funny story about that. I was very poor. I had gotten out of the shelter and I was living in a small apartment. My rent was more than my welfare check, so they were giving me the difference. And one Sunday morning, one of them picked me up for service and she gave me a little bag. And I opened the bag and it had a bottle of deodorant, a bar of soap, a toothpaste, and a toothbrush in it. And I joke with her now because she's one of my dear friends. And I asked her, well, you're trying to tell me that I was smelly, but that's the kind of love and support they gave me without the conditions, you know. And they accepted me. They knew I was gay and they didn't care, you know. They just saw me as one of God's children, if you will. And it was in that church, in the basement of that church, that I started doing plays. And if you were to look at the board of directors of Living the Dream, you will see four people who were members of that church. And the church is now closed, like so many inner city churches. The connection that I had with those people was so strong. And in a lot of ways, they have become my family. When I have problems in relationships, I call one of them. When something negative happens in my life and I don't know how to deal with it, I call one of them. And they have really proven to be that strength, that support that every individual needs. But I don't want to leave people with the impression that there was a snap experience that took me from being homeless to being successful and comfortable. What basically happened is what happens in everybody's life. When you look at yourself and say, this is not right and I want to change, it is a slow, arduous process. But if you don't lose faith, one morning you will wake up and say, I am a different person.
Some of your plays address gangster culture and how young people emulate gangsters in their dress and in their language and their attitudes toward women. And I think, you know, gangster culture is so involved in this really macho ethic. And I think judging from the lyrics of rap, of some rap records, there's a lot of homophobia within that part of youth culture. And I wonder if you address that directly in your plays or not.
No, I don't. And, you know, it's been a very interesting decision for me. I did not want to be labeled as a gay playwright. So until I've probably spoken more about my sexuality in this interview than I have up until this point, and I do that for a very strange reason. I kind of do my homework before I do something and know what the demographics of the listening audience are. And I know that people who would listen to a program like this are not as homophobic as a rule as people who would come see one of my plays. In my plays, I try to build a kinder, gentler bridge to understanding. I talk in terms of compassion issues, how if we turn gay people away, where do they go? I talk about the fact that our attitudes force gay people into the cruising places, forced gay people into the behavior that leads to HIV and AIDS, force gay people into suicide and depression, trying to get people to understand that while I don't understand it, I have to create a bridge that my friends and my loved ones can come to me and say, I'm gay, and I can tell them I still love you, you know, because I don't want them to die. And in my plays, that's what I try to do. And sometimes it works. And sometimes after the plays, we have very heated discussions about these issues. I never forget at Mississippi Valley State University a few years ago, a gentleman stood up and we had this whole debate about whether the gay movement and the civil rights movement had anything in common. And he, along with one of my actors, because they don't have to agree with what I say, very fervently said there is no comparison. And here I was, the only person in the whole theater that stood up for my position. And not at this point in time, these people did not know whether I was gay or straight, because I didn't think that was that important an issue. But what I did say is, God calls us to love and not to judge.
Several of your plays are about women. And I'm wondering if you're writing about women as a way to discuss, to critique certain aspects of macho culture without having to write it from an explicitly gay point of view.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. I find a certain... Well, let me back up and say this. I don't want to give you the impression that simply because I'm gay, I am totally feminist and cool about my relationships with women. Because I write about women, I realize that I too was socialized to be a rapist and a molester and an abuser of women, like all men in Western civilization are. And the only thing that keeps me from doing that is my constant checking myself and saying I cannot reduce women to objects of sexual desire or tools of domesticity, which is so easy to happen. And because I was raised in a household where my sisters washed dishes and the boys carried out the garbage and mama didn't work and daddy brought home the money. And I watched the Brady Bunch on television, you know, and that was, we had kids just like they did. We were a family of eight, just like they were, and we even had a maid sometimes. So I was raised to be this macho man myself. And the process of researching and writing about women has forced me to really come to terms with a lot of my own issues, but has also given me voice as a gay man to avoid to address the whole macho culture in a broader sense. But I don't want to let myself off the hook because I remember many occasions when I have gone to that very negative place in my mind when it comes to women that I have to constantly check myself on.
So are you a little divided between what you want? I mean, do you as a playwright want to get on Broadway, but does the activist in you want to stay in community groups and colleges?
Let there be no doubt. I want to get on Broadway. Please, please. If anybody's listening, I want to get on Broadway. But I don't want to get on Broadway at any terms. You know, when you look at musicals like Rent and Bringing the Noise, Bringing the Funk, and Defending the Caveman even, I realize that I'm much closer now than I've ever been because there's a movement in legitimate American theater, if I can use that phrase, for the raw, hard-hitting, real-life type theater that my theater is about. And I believe that if we keep focusing on the quality of the work, those experiences, maybe not on Broadway, maybe off Broadway, will happen because we have some good stuff. But I'm not preoccupied with it. I don't have a publicist in New York trying to, you know, get me in with producers and what have you. I just am kind of like putting out the energy for it to happen when it is time. Because one of the things I've learned in my life is a lot of things happen before it is time and we get knocked out in the fifth round and don't get a chance to really enjoy it. So we have to really just be patient sometimes and let things happen. But I don't think that there would be any conflict with my plays being in legitimate theatrical venues and people who go see theater just for the joy of seeing theater, viewing them, in appreciating them. Now, I will say when we were in New York before, it was a different story. I was very much self-indulgent. I didn't understand how to respect the time of the audience. My play was almost 3 hours long, and I thought that's okay because everything is important to me. What I've learned since then is you got to respect the time of your audience, and you have to pull yourself out of it somewhat and really create a better piece of theater.
Jim Chapman, just one quick last question.
Sure.
You were born with the name Chapman, and you changed
Correct.
It to Myn?
Yes.
Why?
Because I've never met a person with the last name something lady or something woman or something female. And I've always wondered why. And I know that man is kind of like the generic scientific term for humanity. But it also is, in my mind, a term that says everything has to be connected to the masculine side of who I am. We refer to God in the masculine and we refer to humanity in the masculine. And I wanted to remove myself from that, not so much for other people, but to constantly remind me that there is a feminine energy out here that is so much more benevolent, so much more compassionate, so much more understanding, so much more literate, so much more creative and artistic that I want to be in touch with.
James Chapman, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry Gross.
James Chapman's production company, Living the Dream, is based in Columbus, Ohio, where his new play, The Colored Lady Society, is running through the end of March. His other plays include Our Young Black Men Are Dying and Nobody Seems to Care, and What About Black Women? ¶¶ Coming up, Count Basie, The Golden Years. This is Fresh Air. Many jazz musicians have died prematurely, cut down by disease, accident, narcotics, and even murder, the respective fates of Eric Dolphy, Clifford Brown, Charlie Parker, and Lee Morgan. But many other jazz stars live and keep working well beyond the average retirement age. Count Basie had spent over 50 years on the road by the time he died in 1984, at the age of 79. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews an anthology of recordings Basie made between 1972 and 83. Kevin says Basie's last years can be problematic.
Count Basie was famous because of the big band he brought from Kansas City to New York in 1936, a band which taught by example how to swing hard with a light touch. That band was a classic, but far fewer people ever saw it than saw the orchestra Basie led in his last decades, which was a very different group. The original Basie band worked up their simple blues and riff arrangements in performance. In the 1950s, Basie began using arrangers who wrote more elaborate versions of those old routines. Basie stuck with that idea till the end, and it could still work very well. But by the 1970s, there were a lot of excitable moments when the band could sound like a parody of itself. That comes awful close to being jazz, the cliché. The blues is still in there, but buried under layers of caked-on makeup. Music like that is why the Basie band's surprise appearance in the comedy western Blazing Saddles was so funny. Their sound was as overstated as a Mel Brooks joke. There is a lot of such music in the 4-CD box Count Basie, The Golden Years, a representative sample of recordings he made for the Pablo label after he turned 70. But that box also shows that up until the end, there was another Count Basie to be reckoned with, the piano player who learned to play stride bass lines at the knee of the great Fats Waller. On a blues for trio named after tap dancer Baby Lawrence, Basie varies the dynamics and density of his own playing, a spontaneous version of what his arrangers wrote for big band. Count Basie with Ray Brown on bass and Louis Belson on drums. Basie's record producer in the 70s and 80s was Norman Granz, who had a habit of recording veteran jazz musicians in varied and mostly undemanding settings. Besides documenting the big band, he got Basie to record in small groups that left him more exposed. Of all the featured guest stars Basie recorded with then, one who fit him best was singer Joe Turner. Like Basie, he came up in the Kansas City scene of the early 30s and was by the late 1970s showing his age. Here's Turner with the same Basie trio, plus guitarist Irving Ashby.
Now if you see my honey dripper, get out there. If you see my honey dripper, get out there. Cause I'd had no real good loving since my little girl been gone.
When the older Basie had Joe Turner or Cleanhead Vincent on vocals, or played in a quartet with Zoot Sims on tenor sax, or even in those many moments when the big band peeled back to let him through, the layers of makeup came away to reveal an aged face more beautiful than what disguised it. The best of later Basie confirms one basic truth about the blues and blues musicians. Once the pilot light is lit, it doesn't go out. No matter what you thought of the last Count Basie orchestra, his blue light was always on.
Kevin Whitehead is currently living and writing in Amsterdam. He reviewed the 4-CD box set Count Basie, The Golden Years on Pablo. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Joyce Lieberman. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.